It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, our guest historian digs into a recent video download from the Associated Press and tells us what he found.
First, one of the most significant problems that's vexed the state in recent years has been the so-called brain drain of young college graduates leaving Wisconsin. According to research from UW-Madison, roughly 14,000 college graduates have left the state each year from 2008 to 2012.
The possible consequences: fewer college graduates in the state means fewer qualified candidates for jobs, fewer entrepreneurs starting businesses, and a murkier picture for economic development. Our next guest is looking to put a dent in the amount of college grads leaving the state, and he's introducing legislation aimed at keeping some of Wisconsin's young minds around.
Dewey Strobel joins us now. He's a Republican state senator from Cedarburg. Senator Strobel, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Let's start with the problem. We spelled it out a little. How big of an issue is brain drain for Wisconsin?
Well, I think it's a big issue. When you look at what the facts and figures show us over the last, and this isn't just the last few years, this is a trend that's been continuing really since the early 90s. Wisconsin has a program called the Academic Excellence Higher Education Scholarship, and it's Wisconsin's only strictly merit-based scholarship program. And this amount really has been frozen since the early 1990s at $2,250 a year. Now, that back in that point in time was 1 year's tuition at one of our universities. Well, nowadays, since it's been frozen, it really is barely even a quarter of what that amount would be to attend a university for a year in Wisconsin. And the intent of this scholarship is to keep the best and brightest in the state of Wisconsin. But this scholarship is simply not achieving its intended purpose anymore. In fact, when you look at a survey that's been done by the HEAB, which is the group that administrates the survey program, 358 out of the 749 surveyed students that took this award, actually, they said it didn't even matter in their decision to take the scholarship. So really less than half say that the dollar amount even influenced their decision.
Well, and Senator Strobel, I want to dig into your legislation on that Academic Excellence Higher Education Scholarship. Now, it seems like there's two problems here. One, as you just said, making it significant enough that Wisconsin kids use that as a factor on where to go to school. Part two, they get out of college trying to tweak it so that it makes sure they stay here for a while. So talk us through what your bill would do to change that.
Well, going from that $2,250, you would basically double that. So it would, the cash award would equal to about half of what one's tuition would be at a university in the state of Wisconsin. So that would be a cash award, doubling the current award that is in place at this point in time. But then what would happen with the other half would be is, again, we want people to put down roots in Wisconsin and live here for the rest of their lives. And what this would do is for the first 5 years of their earnings, they would get a tax credit that would equal the other half of what their tuition was that they incurred by going to school at UW-Madison. So therefore, we can tell the best and brightest college graduates or high school graduates in the state of Wisconsin that they can, in effect, have their education paid for by A, going to school in the state of Wisconsin, and B, living and working in the state of Wisconsin for their first 5 years after they've graduated from college.
Now, how big a price tag would you see on something like this? Or has this, I don't know if the Fiscal Bureau has had a read through yet.
Well, I approached this from a revenue neutral standpoint is what I did. So right now the award is about two scholarships for every school district in the state of Wisconsin. My change to keep it revenue neutral goes to one scholarship for every school district in the state of Wisconsin. And thus, that's how we're able to go from that approximately $2,200 to about $5,000 for the cash award that's necessary to constitute one half. Now, then the other half, of course, is the tax credit, which has many other benefits and isn't scored that in a, the Fiscal Bureau scores that differently. And in essence, that, you know, isn't a cost out of the pocket because there's other benefits that come with that. So that's how it's paid for right now.
And but so it sounds like only half as many students then would ultimately get this kind of scholarship. Do we lose something there, even though there's more benefit in it for those who do get it?
Well, I think you might, and I certainly wouldn't be opposed to it keeping it at the average of two per school district in the state of Wisconsin. I believe it would be beneficial because for the payback, again, these are the students who are going to be the entrepreneurs, the job creators, the benefactors of our universities, the future leaders. These are the best and brightest that we really would like to keep here, and I believe it would be a well-founded investment, quite frankly, to keep it at 900. But to be revenue neutral, I have reduced it to half. And if my cohorts in the legislature deem that this is something important enough that we could actually up it and continue it at 900, I think it would be well worth it. When I look at what we pay out to various, you know, any one business even in this state in any one year to create X number of jobs, and I compare this investment versus, you know, one company to retain jobs in the state of Wisconsin, I see a much greater payback with this, and I think we can move some of those economic development dollars to this program. I think it makes all the sense in the world.
Talking to State Senator Dewey Strobel about legislation he's introducing targeting the brain drain problem here in Wisconsin. Is this still going to be enough of an incentive? Half of this is tax credits. Is the incoming college student thinking tax credits as they pack up for their first day of school?
Well, you know, it's not going to get everybody. It never will. But it's definitely going to move the needle in the direction of keeping more of our best and brightest in the state of Wisconsin.
Now, this is something, as you say, right now it's two students per high school. Under the new legislation, be one per high school. Is this just a drop in the bucket for a wider brain drain problem? Do we need more than just this legislation?
Well, again, it's per school district, not per high school.
I'm sorry, district.
But, you know, I don't think it's a drop in the bucket. I think it's significant. And considering right now we're really, again, another thing that came out of that study, 230 of these scholarships were declined by people that they were offered to and thus went further down to an alternate. So, you know, will this hold everyone? No, I don't think it was ever designed to do that. But will it begin to move the needle? I think it will, and I think that will prove to be a great benefit.
One argument with brain drain is if you build the kind of community young people want to live in, they will come. Is that, do you think, down the road, another opportunity for state legislative leadership to try to make a pull factor from another direction?
Well, I think all those factors go into the decision process of a young graduate to where they want to ultimately live. And I can't control all those, and the intent of this bill isn't to control all those. But it is to deal with one of the problems that is very, very crystal clear, and that is our scholarship program is lacking in incentivizing young people to stay in Wisconsin to go to school, and also this would provide another incentive for them to live and work here. So this isn't going to solve all the world's problems, but it is going to, I believe, like I said, move the needle in the right direction.
Before I let you go, Senator, do you have a timeline in mind for this legislation?
Well, we're hoping that it can pass within the next several months, and this additional benefit for our best and brightest could begin to take place for the graduates of our high schools in 2016.
All right. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That was Dewey Strobel, Republican State Senator from Cedarburg. He joined us to talk about legislation he's introducing aimed at reducing brain drain here in Wisconsin. The Associated Press and its partner, the newsreel archive British Movie Tone, just released about 500,000 clips of historical footage, all up for viewing on AP's new YouTube channel. For history buffs with some time on their hands, the channel offers unique footage, things like Martin Luther King Jr. under arrest in Selma, Alabama, and the bombing of Pearl Harbor.
Our next guest spent some time exploring the new channel, and he joins us now to tell us what he found. Jonathan Pollack is a history professor at Madison Area Technical College. Jonathan, welcome back.
Thanks, Veronica. Nice to be back.
Well, this seems like it's part of a push to digitize and democratize the viewing of stuff that's been usually locked up in museums. It's been in archives, but out of reach for the general public. How big a deal is a footage dump like this for historians and the average person?
Well, I think it's kind of a mixed bag. Based on my look at the site, I kind of poked around on it a few times. It's really good for very recent history. So if you were trying to get video of a story that ran maybe a couple months ago or a couple years ago, it's going to be fairly easy to find. There's going to be a title on there and so forth. If you're trying to go back further, the AP's done a nice job of curating a few kind of playlists on the channel. So if you're looking for wars. There's kind of a channel for that and so forth. But if you're looking for things of like local interest, if you remember, like if you saw a presidential candidate give a speech campaigning in your hometown in 1972
just
or something like that, it's going to be hard to do. The searches also were, you know, I tried just using search terms, and I tried a few random things, and sometimes it seemed to work out, sometimes it didn't. I mean, there's huge potential. I mean, I was trying to, it seems to me like the big thing, more than for individuals or for presentations, it's a way for AP to boast of their stock footage holdings. That's a huge thing for people who are making documentaries, or for people who are making ads. I mean, there are lots of ads out there that involve people photoshopped into historic images, and things like that. And it seems like that's kind of the big market. It's also a little unwieldy to use because each clip comes with an ad at the beginning of it. Like every single one I tried, there was always an ad there. So, you know, you need to really play with it a little bit. If you're going to insert the video like into a presentation, was one of the ideas I had for it, was I thought, okay, I can now take my lectures and just put this AP video in. There's going to be a whole lot of transferring and various like little hacks you can do to get the ad off of there and to edit the clip once it's off YouTube. So for people with stronger technical chops than myself, and for people who do this in their daily work, it's going to be great. For the average person just kind of poking around YouTube and putting off going to bed or getting work done or whatever, it's a little unwieldy, but still kind of interesting. You still stumble on some fun stuff.
Now, I had fun reading some of the pieces about it, because often there's one up on the Central Time Facebook page right now that includes a curated list of 15 cool historical videos that I hadn't seen, which were kind of remarkable. One that I don't know, maybe I would have seen somewhere, but it certainly didn't remember, that had a big impact, was Nelson Mandela leaving prison. Here it is.
There's Mr. Mandela, Mr. Nelson Mandela, a free man taking his first steps into a new South Africa. Mrs. Winnie Mandela next to him, waving to the crowds, hand in hand. They leave the Victor Verster prison. Officials, marshals of the National Reception Committee trying to get the people, and a salute from Mr. Nelson Mandela, his wife Winnie, greeting the people outside the fences of the Victor Verster prison.
And that was a really cool one for me to see. Originally, you and I talked about playing a clip of the Titanic leaving port. Well, it turns out that's from, 1912, and that footage is completely silent. Would have made for the worst audio clip ever, but it was still cool to watch.
Well, and one of the things I liked in the Titanic clip was something that popped up in other clips I viewed as well, and that was the selections, the things that the AP has put up, they're a mix of what actually went out over the air and just raw footage that news editors would cut and paste as needed. So in the Titanic footage, there's a lot of people just kind of standing around, you know, and 1912 standard filming, the editing is much slower, the takes are much longer. So it was a 9-minute clip, and it seemed like it was about half an hour. It just seemed very long to just sit there in front of my computer and watch it. But even on more recent things, like there was I came across Harry Truman campaigning in like 48, I guess. And there are these great shots where you see Truman like kind of testing the mic, and there's no audio, but you can tell he's kind of joking with the people who are on the dais with him. And then he starts talking and the audio comes on, and there's like a campaign speech. And so for me, I really enjoyed like the before and after, like watching the sort of aftermath where the camera just kind of hangs out on the crowd while the politician gets off the stage and people try to go in for handshakes. And you see like that kind of retail politicking where the president's kind of doing it by rote, and then some county chairman or something he knows pops up and he's kind of like, hey, and you know, points at him. And just that, for me, like looking at the everydayness of the people on this footage was kind of neat, because you don't get to see that in an actual newscast. That's all edited out and cleaned up, and you just get the meat of what the story is.
We're talking to Jonathan Pollock right now. He's a history professor at Madison Area Technical College. Recently, the Associated Press, with its partner British Movietone, released about 500,000 clips of historical footage. Jonathan's been digging around in that massive collection to tell us what he found. And you were talking about those behind-the-scenes look. There was one again, not a great clip to play on the radio, but Martin Luther King Jr. being arrested with others in Selma, Alabama. The sound was fuzzy, but you could hear the hoarseness of the police officer trying to arrest the crowds based on what they'd done. You heard singing in the background. You saw the faces. That's pretty remarkable.
Yeah, that I mean that raw footage is really powerful. I mean, that's something for, I don't know, for any aspiring documentarians who are listening this afternoon, would be something to really think about in including, is to get like a little more of that in there, because you get, because again, it's not rehearsed, the sound's not fully on, it's chaotic, it's, you know, things are drowned out and so forth, but that makes it, I feel like that makes it a lot more real. I mean, when you're in a crowd, if you're in a crowd watching something big happening, or you're, you know, it's a scene of protest or some kind of tension, some kind of standoff like that, you really don't know what's going to happen, and you just kind of hear like these random sounds come out, and it might be what you're expecting to hear, it might not be, but to have that footage, it's very real, it's very gritty, and that's kind of a big advantage of the whole collection.
And you mentioned some footage of stuff that actually did air, including a strange little reel of the stock market crash, and also a guy who had, this is prior to the stock market crash segment, but right before that there was an airing of a guy who'd allowed himself to be hit by a car to test this new bumper that rolled him down the street instead of hurting him. But then right into that, they go into this segment about the stock market crash.
October 29th, 1929, Black Tuesday. The New York Stock Exchange is in a panic. Frantic investors have scrambled to unload their stocks at any price. Everyone wants to sell. No one wants to buy. Suddenly, even the most gilt-edged securities are practically valueless. The stock market crash has come, and the Great Depression has begun.
It's funny how cinematized that is.
Well, I think it is cinematized. I mean, people weren't calling it the Great Depression in October of 1929 yet. All they knew was that stocks took a big tumble, and presumably, I think the conventional wisdom at that time was, all right, well, this is a good time to buy. They're coming back up. And they just didn't. You know, stocks continued to fall further. So that, I mean, that clip, and again, that wasn't one that I happened to view when I poked around, but it sounds to me like that was part of a package that AP did on the Depression sometime after the fact. That I think the term Depression is really kind of, you start seeing that like maybe around the time Roosevelt's elected, about 1933 or so. And that prior to that, that wasn't quite in there. So I think that's why it's kind of cinematic, is that when they made that, they kind of knew how it turned out.
It was a degree of separation.
Yeah, right. It wasn't an immediate thing. You know, you go into a movie theater on like, you know, in early November of 1929, and that's what's on the newsreel footage that particular day.
Why do you think that institutions like the Associated Press, and they're not alone in this, there are lots of museums, but why have they been in the habit of sitting on footage and materials that are archival instead of releasing them?
Well, I mean, there's money to be made from it. You know, as I mentioned, the commercial market for that kind of stuff is it's really, you know, it's quite lucrative. They can charge a huge amount of money for a small clip of film. I worked in the film archives at the Wisconsin Historical Society about 20-some years ago when I first moved to Madison. And so I remember we'd get these requests all the time, and it's a constant struggle that people are making ads, people are making films. They want as much footage as possible. If you're making a film, you're just like, you need footage all the time. They want it and they don't want to pay for it. And I think what's kind of going on here is that AP realizes they're kind of losing the battle, that if they sit on it, they have no chance at getting royalties and reuse fees and so forth from entities that want to use it. That by putting ads on there, by having the AP logo in the top of the frame, as many of them do, they have a chance at holding on to that, onto some of that revenue stream. I think they realize that a lot of people are going to get in there and they're going to hack it and they're going to edit it and get it out of there. But it's more they feel like there's a future in getting it out there, getting it online, so people can contact them for proper use according to the laws of copyright, so they can collect some funding from that.
So this is kind of analogous to how the music business is creating digital downloads of individual songs and trying to get a little bit of money off?
I think it is kind of like that. I mean, I think it's also, you know, thinking back to the job I had back in the early 90s, it's also, you know, as happens in music, as happens in lots of fields, it's a way to sort of replace people. You know, in when AP sat on these documents, you'd have to call there and talk to an archivist and say, okay, I want X amount of footage on Y event or with Z person in there or whatever. And now you just do it yourself. You just log on to YouTube and you play around for a while and you say, ah, there he is, Eisenhower, boom. And then you just contact AP and pay for it. And AP doesn't then have to pay for an archivist to go through the catalog and the footage and say, okay, here's a medium shot of Eisenhower giving a speech.
As just a consumer of history, not professionally like you, though, I have to say it was some powerful stuff. I rewatched, against probably my better judgment, the September 11th attacks amateur video. A lot of swears being dropped, maybe very understandably, but it is powerful.
Yeah, no, and I think that goes back to what I was saying about the raw footage, that's some of the real value of it. And it's hard. Raw footage isn't really a search term that they've got that you can use real well. But if you poke around on it, when you see that truly spontaneous stuff instead of the packages done after the fact, yeah, it's real impressive.
John, thanks so much for digging through it with us and talking about it today.
Thanks, Veronica.
We've been talking to Jonathan Pollock, history professor at Madison Area Technical College.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Well, it's safe to say that the internet has brought us a lot of good things. Our access to recipes, movie credits, and shopping has never been better. But there are downsides.
One of those downsides, according to our next guest, is that the online world amplifies our power to publicly shame people. He says an offensive tweet or minor scandal may be deserving of criticism, but things have gotten way out of proportion, with internet mobs ready to strike at the slightest offense.
John Ronson has interviewed people who have been at the receiving end of the global shaming machine about how it affected their lives long after the initial outcry died down. John Ronson is a journalist, documentary maker, and author. His newest book is So You've Been Publicly Shamed. He joined us earlier this year for an interview, and I started by asking him how shame is different now in the digital era.
Yeah, well, the renaissance of shaming on social media is, I think, way worse than it's ever been for so many reasons. It stays around forever. It's wildly out of proportion to the crime. People are being destroyed for bad phraseology. Somebody tells a joke that lands badly, a kind of liberal joke that lands badly, and they are defined for the rest of their lives by some bad phraseology. And then I would meet these people. I would do what nobody else would do, which is actually journey to their homes and meet the people that we destroyed, and they were crushed, they were mangled, and it's carnage.
Well, it's an interesting thing because it seemed like at first this could have been a good thing in your mind, as though justice was being democratized, giving voice to the voiceless and all of that, and then you had your own firsthand experience with public shaming. What's changed in your mind about the way you've thought about it?
You know what I think the problem is that you're right. I mean, we shame people appropriately and we have power in a way that we haven't had power before. So, for instance, I mean, I can think of a million appropriate shamings. Let's say when the NYPD put a man called Eric Garner in a chokehold and he died and nobody was indicted. And as a result of social media, there were protests and they were powerful. And now my guess is that the next time the NYPD has somebody in a chokehold, they might think twice. But I think the problem is that we cannot differentiate on social media between an appropriate shaming and an inappropriate shaming. Our ferocity, you know, the heat of our flame is just as strong for somebody who deserves it as doesn't deserve it. And so somebody making a gag, a liberal joke that comes out badly, gets utterly torn apart. So that's what changed it for me. I'll give you an example.
Sure.
Okay, a woman called Justine Sacco. I mean, she's really kind of ground zero of social media shaming. Just before getting on a plane to Africa, she tweeted, "Going to Africa, hope I don't get AIDS, just kidding, I'm white." So what she was trying to do in a very badly worded way was make a kind of, you know, joke about privilege. She wasn't trying to gleefully flaunt privilege. She was trying to make a joke about privilege in much the same way as, you know, Randy Newman would do in his songs or South Park. But while she slept on the plane and was completely oblivious, her tweet went around the world. Millions and millions of people read that tweet and just decided that she was a racist monster who had to be fired and also had to be defined forever by that tweet. And the fact that she was oblivious to this destruction was part of the hilarity, the fact that we were about to watch this woman get fired in real time before she even knew she was being fired. It's so profoundly undemocratic and so profoundly unjust.
And you talked with her. How did this experience affect her after the outcry was over?
Crushed, I mean broken. I met her in a bar a couple of weeks later. You know, she had barely stopped crying for weeks. It mangles your mental health. She said she would wake up in the middle of the night forgetting who she was. She thought if she was in an accident and lost her memory and then came back and Googled herself, that would be her new reality. She was the monstrous racist AIDS tweets woman. Not only was she fired, but the newspapers were following her to the gym. Almost nobody was defending her because people were too scared to, because social media can be so ferocious. The language that's used is so ferocious. It's like the bullies took over the school.
We're talking with John Ronson now. He's the author of So You've Been Publicly Shamed, talking about the shame culture that we live in online right now. And John, you didn't speak with her in time for your book, but when we think about public shaming, Monica Lewinsky comes to mind, and she recently did a TED Talk about her experience. Here's a clip.
This scandal was brought to you by the digital revolution. It was the first time the traditional news was usurped by the internet for a major news story. What that meant for me personally was that overnight, I went from being a completely private figure to a publicly humiliated one worldwide. I was patient zero of losing a personal reputation on a global scale almost instantaneously.
A clip there from Monica Lewinsky's TED Talks. Now, you talked with her a while back. What did she tell you about what that experience meant to her and shaped her?
Funnily enough, I could tell how vulnerable Monica still was, because I met her a week or two ago. We did an interview together for VanityFair.com, and she wanted to interview me about my book. And whenever I tried to talk to her about what happened to her, she kind of said, oh, you know, let's talk about that another time. So she was still, I think it took an awful lot of courage for her to stand up and give that TED Talk. And I thought she did an absolutely beautiful job. You know, there was a line in that TED Talk that really touched me after being a journalist for 30 years and also somebody who's been writing about public shaming for the last 3 years. She said something like, people forget that I am dimensional and there was a time when I wasn't broken. And there's a game being played on social media where we all pretend that everybody's either... We don't know it's a game. We've kidded ourselves into believing it's real life, where everybody is either a magnificent hero or a sickening villain. Everybody's either just the best person ever or the worst person ever. But we know in our hearts that human beings are dimensional. We're clever and we're stupid. We use good phrasing and we use bad phrasing. We are honest and we make mistakes. And yet, on social media, we've created a stage for these artificial high dramas that that are incredibly damaging for the people at the centre of them.
It is high drama, and it seems as though it might be hard to turn the ship on something like this once it gets going. But, you know, speaking about Monica Lewinsky, she has been speaking out against the culture of public humiliation and trying to get people to back off it a little. Do you think there's hope for that to happen in the age that we live in?
Well, I hope so, but there's a bit of messenger shooting going on too. You know, I'm getting the odd. It's funny, for 30 years I've been writing about abuses of power, about powerful people doing crazy and absurd things. For me, the first time ever that I've been really criticised for it is with this book, is when I'm saying, you know who are the powerful, crazy people now? Us. It's like people love it when I say that about the pharmaceutical industry in my book, The Psychopath Test, or, you know, powerful elites in my book, Them. As soon as I say we are the powerful, crazy people now, a lot of people try and, you know, muddy my name. So whether it's going to make a difference, I don't know. But I will say that, you know, if you read my book, which is quite a sort of dreadful experience, you know, people tell me that their heart pounds when they read this book. You know, they feel the anxiety of what it is to be at the end of one of these shaming campaigns. I think if you read my book and if you watch Monica's TED Talk, which explains, you know, what it feels like so beautifully as well, I think it's going to be harder to shame people. because once you've visited the slaughterhouse, it's kind of harder to eat the steak.
Well, another aspect of this, which could point people in that direction, is the work of a psychiatrist named James Gilligan, who says there's a link between violence and shame. What has he found?
Oh, he is such a smart man, James Gilligan. This is a Harvard psychiatrist who, for the first part of his life, just treated, as he described it, normal neurotics like you and me. And then he got himself involved in the maximum security prison world in Massachusetts because there'd been an epidemic of violence and killings. People were killing each other in the most awful ways inside prison. So he went in to try and make sense of it. And to cut a long story short, what he discovered, as he said to me, was that every single murderer he spoke to had a central secret. And that secret was that they felt ashamed, deeply, chronically, profoundly ashamed, because as children, they'd been beaten, scolded, abused, insulted physically and mentally. And it's no coincidence, he said, that the people who occupy the most violent spectrum in adult life, were treated equally violently as children. And Gilligan said something to me which I thought was so profound and beautiful and something that, we should all remember, which is that he said all violence is an attempt to replace shame with self-esteem, which isn't to excuse violence, but it is to understand it. And so while we are knee-jerk, trigger-happy shamers on social media, Gilligan's work is so important in reminding us that even the worst people, the people in maximum security prisons who've committed murder, benefit from empathy.
Hearing that, and the stories of the people that you speak to, is shame ever a useful emotion? Given that it may lead to violence, that it ruins people's lives, is shame useful? Does it have a public corrective that is useful to society?
When I was in the bubble of writing this book, when I was hanging out with people like James Gilligan, I was rather convinced by the idea that, shaming is never good. The only way to get out of this sort of, echo chamber of shaming is to just step out of it and refuse to shame. But now that the book's out, I sort of feel that maybe that's a bit Disney. And, just today, every day there's another shaming on Twitter. And just today, there was a horrible photograph went around Twitter of a woman hunter who shot a giraffe and was lying jubilantly next to the body of the giraffe. And when I saw that, I was, like everybody else, I was horrified. And I was very careful in my book to only write about people who I felt their punishment was disproportionate to their crime. Ordinary people whose transgressions were very slight. One message of this book is that shaming is an incredibly powerful thing, very powerful. It mangles people's mental health. And the power is in our hands now because everybody is scared of us on social media. So it is our responsibility to be judicious, to use our shaming wisely, because there's no rule book right now. So we have to make the rules ourselves. So I think, there are appropriate shamings, but there's an awful lot of inappropriate ones too.
That's John Ronson talking about the new culture of public shaming that sprung up in the digital era. He joined us back in April for an interview, and we'll have the rest of that conversation in just a moment.
We'd like to hear from you, too. Do you think we're too quick to shame people for their tweets, their misjudgments? Have you ever been part of an angry internet mob? And if so, do you think the punishment of shaming fit the crime? Head on over to the Central Time Facebook page and let us know about it.
We're continuing our conversation with John Ronson. His new book is called So You've Been Publicly Shamed. He looks at the modern day culture of shaming, talks to people who have been the subject of outcries on social media, and says the punishment for minor offenses can get way out of proportion with the original crime. You can join in. Have you ever done this? Have you piled on in an online scandal? Do you agree that there can be a tendency to overreact, or have the rules changed so we should all just be more careful? Tweet us at Central Time WPR. And we go now to Dennis. Dennis joins us from Red Granite. Hi, Dennis.
I just think if people go out there and put things on social media, they're opening themselves up. They're putting their life out there for public to see. And if they say or do something stupid, what do they think is going to happen?
All right. Thanks, Dennis. Pretty much in essence saying live by the sword, die by the sword when it comes to social media. What do you make of that, John?
You know, I don't buy that for a couple of reasons. Firstly, because when Twitter started, it was really a kind of... It felt like a sort of Garden of Eden, you know, the silence had a voice. People were finding their voice, and it was like an eloquent voice. It was a leveling of the playing field, and it was kind of beautiful. People, and, you know, why take that away from people, you know, the chance to be able to broadcast their voice in an eloquent and funny and passionate way? And secondly, Justine Sacco, the woman I talked about earlier, who did the bad joke about AIDS, she had 170 Twitter followers. Nobody ever replied to her tweets. Like, when the New York Times phoned her up to fact-check my book extract, they said to her, were you surprised before you got on the plane that nobody replied to your joke? She said, nobody ever replied to my joke. So I really don't think it was unreasonable for Justine to not expect, while she slept on a plane, for her life to be utterly destroyed. You know, she shouldn't have needed to expect that would happen.
Well, thank you for the call, Dennis. And we're going to go next to Sarah in Zion, Illinois. Hi, Sarah.
Well, hi, Veronica. Something happened with my... I was reading a friend's Facebook account, and you know the singer Michelle Schacht?
Uh-huh.
Well, she supposedly... Well, she made these comments at a concert, which made it sound like she was this horrible homophobic person, and everybody on the Facebook account was just saying, oh, how could she be this way? I've never, you know, I can't believe she turned into this raving maniac. And she had all her concerts canceled. And I just looked a little deeper into the story, and she made the statement that, to me, totally explained why she said that. She was just being sarcastic. She didn't really, those weren't her beliefs. And I believed her. And I posted that on that Facebook account, and nobody spoke to me again. And I just felt like it was an example of how people will read something online and they don't really know much about it, but they just instantly make a decision about it. And I don't know why that is. I feel like people are just thinking more superficially than they used to, or maybe it's when they're just on the internet. I don't know, but... And yeah. I don't know whatever happened to Michelle Schacht. But.
Got it. Thank you, Sarah. Appreciate that. And you know,
I can answer the second part of that conversation, that question, because Michelle Schacht actually came to my event a couple of days ago in Los Angeles.
Oh, what'd she say?
Well, I didn't talk to her, but I saw her sitting in the audience. I know that I'm sure that she regrets the comments that she made on stage, and I think she hasn't been able to get any bookings for the last couple of years as a result of them.
Do you think that people are too quick, you know, just read the tweet, a few lines of text there, and then make a decision instead of looking for the context, the multidimensionality that Monica Lewinsky was kind of talking about there?
Yeah, we are on social media. We are like toddlers crawling towards a gun. You know, we have these knee-jerk responses to some phraseology that, you know, doesn't matter if it's taken out of context, doesn't matter if it's nuanced, but the nuance doesn't come through. You know, we're just in love with what we believe is attacking people who are misusing their privilege. But actually, what it is just beating people up.
Why do you think that is? I mean, do we get pleasure out of that? Do we like to see people punished? Does it appeal to some sort of reptilian part of our brain that likes things to be very black and white?
I think it's... I mean, sometimes I think it's like the it's just the desire to do good, to be seen to be empathetic people. It's always, you know, the people who are shamed these days are people who are seen to have misused their privilege. And of course, that's a better thing to shame somebody for than, you know, the things that we used to shame people for in the 19th century, like, you know, adulterous affairs or whatever. But the problem is we're so in love with getting people who have misused their privilege that we've really let our standards slip. We're getting people for anything, and then we just excuse it as they're another person misusing their privilege. You know, so sometimes I think it's the desire to be seen to be empathetic that's leading us to do these incredibly unempathetic acts. Other times I think it's just cruelty. Sometimes I think it's just people who prefer ideology over humanity, and that's always dangerous. When other human beings are just a blank canvas for you to put your ideology onto. I think some of that goes on social media too. It's terribly destructive.
Let's take another call here. Josh is with us in Madison. Hi, Josh.
Yeah, hi. I had a question for your guest as to whether or not he thinks that, or what he thinks of public officials that deserve shaming, but appear not to be effective or act like they're not. Do you think that they, on some level, they do feel shame as a result of a shame campaign in a situation where maybe they might deserve to be shamed?
So Josh, I guess, kind of saying that with some public officials, I'm not sure who in particular he's thinking of, but maybe there's cause for shame and some people don't seem to feel it.
I mean, my theory, you know, my last book before this one was a book about psychopaths called The Psychopath Test. And you could say that psychopaths don't feel shame. They don't feel remorse or anxiety or guilt because that part of the brain underperforms, whether it's through nature or nurture, is, you know, the jury's out. But honestly, I think those people are really few and far between. I mean, you know, they say that 1 in 100 regular people is a psychopath, which means 99 out of 100 aren't. And my guess is that a public shaming is an incredibly powerful weapon, incredibly effective. And I think, you know, the vast majority of people get really hurt by it. And one of the great ironies of this, of course, is that, you know, there's a woman in my book called Lindsay Stone who made a joke at Arlington Cemetery, which, my God, she's paid for. She posed in front of the silence and respect sign in front of the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier as this kind of douchey joke. She pretended to shout and flip the finger. This was like a running joke where she would pose in front of signs and do the opposite. Such a lovely woman. Her job was to work with adults with learning difficulties. And the joke, you know, backfired and she was publicly shamed across the internet, fell into deep depression, didn't leave home for a year and a half. One of the ironies of that is that it's the sweetest people who suffer the most when it comes to a public shaming.
Do you think it's just that in that instant captured forever, that something can never really be seen in its entirety? That moment, say, with Lindsay might have been a second of a joke with a lot of respect at other points. Is it just taken out of context?
Yeah, and yes, and it's such a dangerous thing to do, this kind of constant swinging pendulum on social media between celebrating heroes and vilifying villains. Yeah, in real life, you know, there aren't many magnificent heroes, and there aren't many significant, you know, there aren't many sickening villains. What almost all of us are kind of in the middle, right? And that's the grown-up way of treating human beings, as being dimensional.
That was John Ronson, author of So You've Been Publicly Shamed. He joined us back in April to talk about today's culture of online shaming and the effect it can have on the people being shamed.